Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Really appreciate you taking time today for joining us for another edition of Midrats. A reminder to those that are joining us live, if you wanted to scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you can find the chat room. We already have a few guests lined up. That's a great place to go if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guests and it doesn't look like we're heading that direction, you can go ahead and put it right there in the chat room. Eagle One and I will be monitoring that during the course of the show, and we'll hop right in there and fold it into the conversation. If you have to leave halfway through the show, or if this is your first time to Midrats and you want to catch up on the other 5.5 years of shows we've done, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or just take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast we have over on iTunes. But hey, enough of that. Let's get on with the show. From the Baltic to the Black Sea, the last year has seen the North Atlantic Treaty Organization return to its roots, the defense of Europe from Russian aggression. Some of the names and players have changed in the last couple of decades, but in many ways, things look very, very familiar. And our guest today to discuss NATO's challenge in the East for the second half of the 21st century, and we're going to have him for the full hour, is going to be Dr. George Benitez. George is the director of NATO Source and a senior fellow in the Atlantic Council's Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security. He specializes in NATO, European politics, and U.S. national security. He's previously served as assistant for alliance issues to the Director of NATO Affairs in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He has also served as a specialist in international security for the Department of State and the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. Dr. Benitez received his BA from the University of Florida and his master's in public policy from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He wound up his PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. George, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to our discussion.
Perfect. And just as kind of a kickoff here, you know, we go back to a decade and a half, NATO has made a great effort to go from static forces, some of which, especially in our new alliance members from the former Warsaw Pact, getting away from barely being able to leave their base to really being an expeditionary force with over a decade working together in Afghanistan. And we've seen recently that there was a little bit of an interlude with the Libya operations, but there's been a great discussion now of a refocus on something that has always been a NATO core mission, and even some of the tactics. There's been a few speeches recently about relearning and a refocusing on maneuver warfare. Is NATO going to refocus back to its tradition and try to forget expeditionary, or are we going to keep what we've earned in the last decade and a half but being a little more cognizant of perhaps what has become the top shelf concern of the last few years?
It's going to be a challenge because, as you pointed out, the security situation has changed. Since before 2007, when Vladimir Putin was at the Bucharest NATO summit and he opposed Georgia's membership into NATO, and NATO decided not to allow Georgia into NATO, that didn't stop Putin from invading Georgia a few months later. And then we saw last year with his invasion of Crimea and Ukraine, we see second time in just the last 8 years, a major power in Europe has invaded its neighbors and has really broken the post-Cold War environment where the Europeans and the United States had been disarming and withdrawing their troops and cutting their defense budgets because they thought the Cold War was over, Europe was a continent at peace, But because of Putin's actions, that peace has been shattered. And as you said, during that time of disarmament in within Europe, there were important missions outside of Europe. The one and only time that the alliance has used the Article 5 clause, which is the Common Defense Clause, in the Washington Treaty, which states that an attack on one member is an attack on all of them. That was used after the 9/11 attack. And it's for that reason that our NATO allies and other partners joined us in the ISAF mission in Afghanistan to go after the people that had launched that attack against the United States. And as you pointed out, for 10 years now, our NATO forces with the United States there have gained a lot of interoperability, a lot of experience working together. But they were kind of focused on that external threat. But Putin's actions have really changed that, and now a lot of the NATO members, particularly the ones closest to Russia's borders, they feel very much threatened. They don't want to be next on Putin's list. Russia is very much active within NATO borders in terms of espionage, political corruption, intelligence, and activities of that sort. And so in some ways, Russia has already crossed the NATO threshold of Article 5 and is trying to be very subversive in NATO members. And so they want more of the reassurance, and the kind of reassurance that was given during the Cold War for the frontline state during that conflict, which was West Germany, where we had over 250,000 U.S. troops stationed in Europe at that time. Now we're down to about less than 70,000 altogether. The army is down to two brigade combat teams and one on a rotational basis. So, as you said, NATO is focusing back on this common defense, territorial defense of its members, and trying to restore deterrence to Europe. But at the same time, we still have a lot of instability along the Mediterranean rim. We still have a major anti-ISIL coalition that is composed of mostly of NATO members. It's not a NATO operation, but it's resourced by the United States and many of our NATO allies. So we're still involved in that type of expeditionary counterterrorism, counterinsurgency type mission at the same time.
Has Putin, I mean, we U.S. announced we were going to refocus our attention on Asia, and Putin, in the meantime, has become the bully boy of Europe again. He's threatening, I think in your U.S. news article recently, you noted that he's been threatening Sweden and Finland not to join NATO. He obviously prevented Georgia from joining NATO. Is this just Putin, or is this the standard threat to Europe that always comes from the East?
No, this is a very Putin specific, and it's actually a change in Putin's policy. When he first became president, it was in the context of taking over for the Yeltsin presidency, who had been a partner with the West. And it was also in the context of the post 1991 Gulf War against Saddam Hussein to liberate Kuwait. So it was at a time of political partnership between NATO and Moscow, and also was a time of Western military superiority. So Putin at that point was trying to be nice and get along with the West. But like I said, around 2006-2007, he begins to manifest much different anti-Western rhetoric. He becomes much more defining himself in Russia and trying to perceive a threat from NATO. It's also around 2007 that we begin to see the beginning of Russia's military expansion. Up until that time, like everyone else, like the NATO members, they had been trying to live off the peace dividend and cut their defense spending. But around the 2007 period, Putin started to make defense a greater priority and to increase Russia's defense budget. So in 2008, 2009, 2010, 2012, all up until this current year, Russia has been increasing its defense spending and its military capabilities. So what was somewhat difficult for Russia to do when it was fighting the first Chechen War, it became more successful in the second Chechen War. It became even more successful in their capabilities in their war against Georgia. And then we saw how quickly they moved in and took over to Crimea and really seized a large part of eastern Ukraine, what's called the Donbas region. They really upped their game and improved their capabilities in a way that has surprised many political and military leaders in the West. And then you couple that with, at the same time, ever since 1991 and the end of the Cold War, the West has continued to cut its defense spending. And even though for the last 8 years, Russia has been increasing it and made the change, the West has continued to cut its defense spending. And in fact, the United States, according to the last DOD budget submitted, we're still cutting our DOD budget, we're still cutting our defense spending, and we're still planning on withdrawing more of our forces from Europe in spite of the threat coming from the East.
I think one of the interesting things is having to overcome my own biases. I remember a few years ago, everybody was making a joke when the first moves were made on the Crimea that a bunch of old guys smelling of mothballs were coming out of the bowels of the Pentagon, waving around their Russian language credentials and their Soviet thinking, because everybody had dismissed Russia for years. But in part of the biases is when a lot of people think of Russia, they think of the Soviet Union, and they're clunky, they're awkward, they're too rigid. But I think what we've seen in the Donbass region and also in Crimea is, some are calling it hybrid warfare. I don't like buzzwords, but that is what people are using. There has been a fair bit of nimbleness and economy of force where people are still trying to figure out what they're doing. I don't think it's the weekly bumble. There's got to be some connection there. And with that has been, we first saw it, I think, about 8 years ago or so when the Russians went after the Estonian computer system, that Russia's cyber capability is fairly impressive, if you can look through your biases of the Russians not being very sophisticated. How much of the Russian cyber that they're working is just another medium of good old-fashioned espionage, and how much of it is more of a play for psyops and info ops with their little army of trolls that we see all over the place? And do you think that the NATO nations and the U.S. really appreciate the direction Russian cyber is going and how it is facing our NATO countries?
That's an excellent question. Let's begin by pointing out that the latest Russian military doctrine, what we sometimes call the Gerasimov doctrine, based on the Russian general who first put it forward recently, Russia is never at peace. It's just in various stages of conflict. So at the very best, it's a very low-level, minimal area of conflict, and then they escalate depending on their interest and their level of threat. The Russian strategic documents have identified NATO as, they claim that NATO is the main threat to Russia, and their use of things such as cyber is much more extensive than we use in the United States and in the West. For the Russians, as you said, cyber is part of their normal day in and day out espionage, both economic and political and criminal. The Russians have a close relationship with private hackers, what we sometimes call patriotic hackers, and even with the organized crime elements in Russia, in ways that you don't see those types of relationships in the West. And their expertise and their success at cyber can run the gamut, anything from the Georgian, about 3 years ago, the Georgian's defense ministry did an excellent honey trap in that they created a drive on their in their network that said it had NATO documents about NATO membership information. And they were able to lure in Russian hackers who went into those files and took that information back. When they took it back, they took malware that the Georgians had set up. And through that malware, the Georgians hacked the webcams of the Russian hackers. So they actually had video of the Russian hackers trying to get into the Georgian Defense Ministry's network. We posted that on NATO Source. You have the 2007 cyber attack against Estonia. This kind of lets us understand what level of unpredictability and what kind of an irrational and poor strategist that Putin actually is. Putin instigated the first major state-sponsored cyber attack in history And it was not because there was any major troops were massing on the Estonian border or there was some threat against Moscow. The reason why he launched that is because the Estonians were moving a statue, a war memorial that was pro-Soviet, and the Estonians wanted to get rid of it from outside this park near the center of their capital and move it into a more obscure place. So because of that very, what I would call, trivial matter, the movement of a statue, Russia instigated a significant and major cyber attack against a NATO member. What we see most recently, that was 8 years ago, but in their military operations against Crimea, we saw that cyber and electronic warfare, which is a major component of Russian operations, were used quite effectively to literally cut off all communications and command and control from Kiev to Crimea. So one of the biggest reasons why the Russians were able to take hold of the Ukrainian bases is because the Ukrainian soldiers basically had no information, were not able to receive any orders of how to respond to the Russians. The only information and guidance they had is what the Russians gave them. So they used it in a very blunt way to sort of cut the head off all of the Ukrainian units in Crimea. And they did that both through digital means, but also through physically taking control of key digital networks and electronic systems that took care of the information flowing into Crimea. So we see a very integrated, very broad, and increasingly successful and capable military options for the Russians in the way they use cyber, both in their doctrine and the way they've been doing it in practice so far.
When the Russians threaten Sweden and Finland about joining NATO, one of the things you noted in your article was that they try and intimidate them, and you suggested that part of that was that they would, the Russians, just like they did with Ukraine, have come up with these rather flimsy excuses as to why they need to engage in military endeavors against Ukraine in this case. And you said they might try and do that against Sweden and Finland. What possible justifications could they use against either of those countries?
Well, unfortunately, it's not a question of how rational the justifications are, because they had no rational justifications for the steps that they took in Crimea or in Donbass. I mean, there were no reports of any ethnic conflict, of any ethnic abuses against the Russians. There was no public, coming out of wanting an independence movement, neither in Crimea nor in eastern Ukraine. The demographics in Crimea may have been of Russian ethnicity, but there was no indication that politically that they wanted to rejoin. And for me, one of the clearest symbols of the fact that there was no sincere native independence interest in joining Russia is that the so-called referendum, the vote that the Russians had, was so blatantly coercive, so much run by their military, that no one really had a choice. If Putin himself truly believed that the people in Crimea would overwhelmingly support joining Russia, that he could have had a free election, and he could sort of use that to gain some legitimacy as an excuse. But he had no faith in their own support, so that's why I believe that was not a real rational claim. The other claim is a question of the relationship of Ukraine and NATO. He may have said that he used the excuse of Ukraine's relationship with NATO as possibly joining NATO, but that's blatantly false as well, because at that time, the question of Ukraine joining NATO was totally off the table. Kiev did not want it, and Brussels did not want it. They were still partners, and they were working together, and just as Russia is a NATO partner, and there was still dialogue and cooperation between the two. But there was no movement headed forward between deepening the relationship between NATO and Ukraine and bringing it closer to membership. So that was a non-issue, but that just by raising that issue, the label of it, Putin was able to confuse and mislead a lot of people in his own country and in Europe and in our country, even some very smart, well-educated people, into thinking that the question of NATO membership had anything to do with what he did in the Ukraine. The operations that started in Ukraine were done under his orders and at his timing and done by his forces, both in Crimea and in Donbass. The The tricky part about Sweden and Finland is that they are far closer to joining NATO than Ukraine ever was, because they have they also are NATO partners. They have a very close relationship, and because of Putin's actions, his invasion of Georgia, his invasion of Crimea and eastern Ukraine, what has traditionally been in those countries the no vote outnumbers the yes vote. Well, in the past year, we've seen the poll numbers rising in Sweden, so that now there are several significant polls that show that the yes vote for Sweden to join NATO is now over 50%, but it's in the 40s, and it's larger than the no vote, which is now in the 30s. And so you have a significant portion that's still undecided. But the more and more that Putin undergoes the type of measures that he's doing, the more he continues to heat up the frozen conflict in eastern Ukraine through more artillery, through more use of force, the way that his military forces violate Swedish and Finnish airspace and have mysterious submarines going into their maritime territory as well. He's just acting very provocatively, very coercive. The statements coming out of the Russian leadership are also trying to coerce and intimidate Helsinki and Stockholm. So just as he miscalculated into thinking that Ukraine, or using that as an excuse of Ukraine being too close to NATO, he could use the same other type label to say that Sweden and Finland are too close to NATO, and try to do and initiate some sort of hybrid land grab, just enough to create some frozen conflict with them, and sort of do the Georgia option, which is just initiate some sort of frozen conflict so that one of the conditions for joining NATO is you have to have no outstanding border disputes with your neighbors. So if Russia did that, it would pretty much put a block on any real chance they have of joining NATO.
Yeah, it's interesting. Back at the end of the last decade, I was sitting around a table in Stockholm with some Swedish and Finn army officers, and we even had a token Norwegian at the table. That's one thing we were actually talking about is coming into NATO, and one of the Finns that was with me looked at me and said, from Finland's point of view, it's the older generation of politicians. Once they pass for power, if conditions are right, he thought that the Finnish people would want to join NATO, and the Swedes are in general agreement that if they won't go until Finland goes. I guess time will take its own path, and Russia's latest moves are heading that direction. But I guess a secondary indicator as well has been when you look back at the height of the Cold War, Finland to a lesser extent, but especially Sweden, did spend a lot of money on their military, especially their Air Force, as a percent of their GDP. And they have really seen a contraction in that investment in their military infrastructure. Have we seen a move? Rhetoric is one thing and desire is another thing. And I guess you could mitigate your own spending by joining NATO if you wanted to. But have we seen an indication of the Finns and the Swedes willing to vote with their pocketbook and invest in their own defense, if for no other reasons than to make themselves less of an attractive target to the Russians? I know the Swedes are looking at remilitarizing Gotland, but how's the monetary situation looking in those two countries as well?
Well, it's a yes or no type of answer, because the Swedes and the Finns have increased their defense budgets because of Russia's actions. They are trying to acquire some capabilities that they've lost. But it's also a no question, because they're not raising it enough. They're not raising it proportional to the threat. They're not raising it to the historical level that you pointed out that they had in the past. And they're not raising it enough to the level that their own senior military leaders think would be are what's needed to deal with the new threats coming from the east. The chief of defense of the Swedish Armed Forces last year made some headlines in the region because he was responding to a question from the press, and he said, at our current capabilities level right now, we could only last about a week against a Russian attack unless we had some help from our neighbors and from others. So if Sweden's at that stage already, one of the things that's also part of the debate that needs to be focused on is that, as you said, there's a lot of misconceptions about their traditional relationship between Sweden and Finland with Russia and the West. And there are a lot of assumptions that are no longer valid. For example, a lot of people still believe that Sweden and Finland are neutral. And as the senior leadership from Sweden has pointed out, they're not neutral. They're part of the EU now. They have certain political and military obligations to the EU and what's called the Mutual Defense Clause and the Solidarity Clauses in the EU treaties, in the Lisbon treaties. So in a way, Sweden and Finland are not part of NATO, but they do have a relationship. They are part of the EU, and they have a strong relationship with the other European powers.
Well, I saw the other day that Finland announced that it could not help Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia in defending themselves from Russian aggression. That these are all everybody but Finland in that group is a NATO country, and it brought to my mind are these three Baltic countries, you know, speed bumps on the way of Russia moving up against the Polish border, and if that happens, I mean, I don't know how much we've let our NATO has allowed its shipping assets to, you know, the reforger type thing. Is that strong enough to resist a hard push by the Russians?
No, unfortunately, NATO's military and especially its maritime capabilities are far smaller than they used to be and far smaller than they should be to deal with the threat. NATO has two standing naval maritime groups, both of which are currently at half strength of what they're supposed to be, even though we've been dealing with Russian aggression for over a year now in Ukraine. The situation in the Baltic has changed a great deal, because during the Cold War, the flanks of NATO, the North and the South, the Northern region and the Baltic and the Black Sea region were important, but the main and most central part that everybody focused on was in the Central Front, the what's so called Fill the Gap, and in defending the major potential Soviet attack through West Germany. That's where most of the forces were, but that in the 20th century. But now in the 21st century, the geography has changed, so that because of the new members in NATO and the fact that the Baltics are now the frontline states, most of the forces were and the geographic area where NATO and Russian forces are rubbing together, or where we're seeing the friction, is in the Baltic Sea region. That's where we're having most of these air violations, most of these maritime very close encounters in those areas. And like I said, so there's a lot of activity there. That's going to be the main point, because that's now where NATO's borders are. They're no longer in Germany, but NATO's borders with Russia are in the northeast along the Baltic Sea region. And then you have that interesting composition of it, so that you have certain states in the Baltic region, such as the Baltics, Republics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. You've also got Poland and Germany and Denmark that are NATO states. You've got Russia, who's not a NATO state, and then you've got Sweden and Finland, who are not NATO members, but who control key airspace and maritime space for the sea lanes of communication for either side if there's a conflict over the Baltics. And then in addition to this, we also have to factor in this new wrinkle of geography, which is Kaliningrad. Any efforts to defend the Baltic states, any efforts to help the Baltic states militarily will not go through Kaliningrad, but they'll go through the Kaliningrad kill zone. And the Russians have put in some serious military capabilities in Kaliningrad. It's a major maritime base. They've got air assets there. They've got missile systems there that can reach every place from the Baltic republics to the Warsaw to even Berlin if they deploy their S-400 missiles there. So there's only a very narrow strip of territory between in Poland that you can go up through to Lithuania to help the Baltic states there.
I started to drift back west a bit, and I believe y'all actually covered this over at NATO Source. If not, I'm sure you're familiar with it. But
Henry Kissinger, God bless him, if I have one-tenth the mind he does at his age, I'll be in good shape. He, and I always like to remind people, you know, Henry Kissinger actually fought in World War II up there on the Dutch and German border as they were headed east. But anyway, he made some interesting comments about Germany in Eastern Europe and the disappearance and what he's seen in the new German leadership, the loss of that core of that Atlanticist mindset that really tied Germans' view of their role with that of the U.S. How do we stand in Germany right now with the challenges headed to the east that might be a little different than what some people assume, thinking about Germany's role in NATO in the past?
Again, that's another excellent question, because Germany plays a pivotal role in European security. Whichever role direction that Germany moves in will have a lot of influence. Germany is the main economic power in Europe. It has the potential to be the main military power in Europe. And because of its location and of its size and its capabilities, how German leaders act and the way that they treat both the threat from the east and their partners and allies in the west has a lot of influence in what's taking place in Europe, and especially in European security. I agree with the concerns about the potential decoupling of German leaders and German public support for the Western alliance, for their partnership with their NATO allies, and also for the commitments as being members of the alliance. There was a very controversial survey that was done by the Pew Research Trust that came out a few months ago that showed that a lot of public and NATO member states, when asked the question of would your country support one of your a NATO ally if they were in a conflict with another state, the majority of the German respondents said no. When asked, would you choose to side with Russia or NATO or try to mediate between the two in any type of conflict, the majority of the German respondents said that they would try to mediate rather than choose siding with the NATO side. So these are disturbing trends from the public support, but also some of the decisions being made by Chancellor Merkel is very troubling, because this emphasis on diplomacy and peace in our time at all cost, slavish clinging on to the Minsk II Accords, and now there's even talk that there may be a Minsk III Accords, when it's clear to everyone that the Russians have broken the Minsk II Accords just as they broke the Minsk I Accords, just as they broke the Georgia ceasefire agreements, that it's any deal made with Moscow right now and its current leadership only has paper value behind it, because it's not enforceable and it's not being enforced by the Russians. We need to have some other options to get them to change their behavior. And the sort of priority that we seem to be seeing from Berlin is to care more about Russia's feelings and bringing Russia back into a positive relationship with the West, looking for so-called off-ramp options to de-escalate the conflict in Ukraine, and not putting as high a priority on the legitimate security concerns of their NATO allies, who now have to deal with a much more aggressive, hostile, and potentially dangerous Russia on their borders. Germany and their leadership is really putting a block on some of the requests made by the Eastern allies, particularly the new president of Poland, who is asking for a permanent NATO military presence in their states, just as West Germany had during the Cold War. But Germany and France and some others are very much reluctant to grant that kind of approval. So the decisions being made by Germany are having a political and diplomatic impact, and also in defense spending. The German defense budget is being increased a little bit this year. Last year at the Wales Summit, all of the NATO members committed to trying to shoot for the 2% 2% of GDP being spent on defense as sort of a NATO target, a NATO pledge. The Germans are making, after initially cutting their defense budget after Wales, they had a scandal with readiness, which I think is an important topic we should get to later, hopefully. But the Germans, because of that scandal, are increasing their defense budget a little bit to increase their readiness a little bit. But again, not nearly to the level that it needs to be to solve all of their readiness problems, let alone to improve their deterrence capabilities and their ability to fulfill their NATO Article 5 obligations.
Well, two quick questions. One has to do with the energy that the Germany and France and a couple of other countries get from Russia. Is that a big part of their thinking about trying to be friends with Russia? And secondly, talk a little bit about this readiness crisis that they have when you get a chance.
I think that the energy question is important. I don't think it's decisive. I think it's part of an overall larger inclination. I think the main challenge here is this desire to find a diplomatic solution to try to talk the Russians back into peace. I'm sort of confused by it because I think the main lesson of NATO and the Cold War was we needed to have strength, we needed to have a strong defense, we needed to have deterrence in Europe, and that's what kept the peace for 50 years. It wasn't the diplomats that kept the peace. It was those millions and millions of NATO soldiers literally guarding the West German border from any attack from the east. And once we found a Russian leadership that was willing to go away with that, to stop this sort of threat to the West and to work on a more positive relationship with the West, then the West was very happy to disarm and pursue this much more cooperative relationship. So that once we had a Gorbachev and a Yeltsin, we could work with those leaders and then everyone can disarm and spend more on their domestic things. But when you have a dangerous leader like Putin, who is using force to attack his neighbors and who's putting forth some really dangerous sentiments, like his claim that he has a right and an obligation to protect Russian minorities and no matter in what country they're in. I mean, that raises some very historical analogies. He's used it to justify the military force he's used so far. And for those NATO members that are close to Russian borders that have Russian minorities living within them, they kind of have to wonder themselves, is he going to use that same excuse to try to cause us harm? Particularly when we're already seeing, when those countries are seeing an increase in Russian espionage and political activity and involvement in their media and in trying to buy some of their local elections. All of these things are very disturbing signs from a Russian leadership that isn't interested in partnership, isn't interested in cooperating, but needs to be dealt with in a way that had worked in the past rather than focusing on diplomacy, which is what Germany's main emphasis seems to be right now. Addressing the question of readiness, this is a problem for all of the NATO allies, including the United States, but it's most severe for the Europeans because they've been doing most of the defense cuts and most of the disarming since the Cold War. And so we had a situation recently where there was a scandal because the German units that were doing their training for the NATO Response Force, which is supposed to be the elite of the alliance, the most readily deployable units, well, for part of their exercise, they didn't have machine guns on their vehicles. So what the soldiers did is they got some broomsticks and they painted them black and they put them on their vehicles and pretended that's what they were going to use. And if we're going to count on broomsticks for the NATO elite unit, that doesn't bode well for the rest of the alliance in terms of deterrence and of our readiness. And soon after that, there was a major report from the Bundeswehr to the German parliament, which kind of laid forth that overall, it's not just the army, it's pretty widespread, and it's not just broomsticks. Less than half of Germany's combat fighter aircraft are deployable and are rated operational. There was a fiasco when the German defense minister tried to go to Iraq and send some military equipment to the Kurds to help them fight ISIL, Her personal jet made it there on time. The airplane that was taking the equipment, it broke down in Bulgaria. The Germans tried to send another plane to take the equipment. That one broke down as well. The plane carrying the trainer that was supposed to show the Kurds how to use the equipment, that one broke down as well. So it took four planes to get the equipment finally to Iraq. And by that time, the defense minister had already come back. So it's a widespread problem in the German forces. It's a problem that other military forces have as well. There was a recent report a couple of weeks ago about the Dutch infantry complaining that they didn't have enough ammunition for their training exercises. So they were reduced to yelling bang, bang when they were having their military exercises to get ready. These are things that the Russians seize. So even though we might have large numbers of troops in our papers and in our documents and in our exercises, the Russians see our level of readiness, and that really weakens our deterrence against them.
There's another side to that coin, the money talks, material condition talks, but there's also the willingness to take action. What's the old, okay, so what are you going to do? And what we've seen in the last year is, in a large measure, in Central and Eastern Europe, when it was time to make a statement for NATO, it were North American forces that were doing it, mostly U.S. There were actually some Canadians that came over to play as well. And when you looked at the parade ground, if the European nations are serious about not only their EU alliances but their NATO alliances, when things get a little edgy in Central and Eastern Europe, how much reinforcement do the Poles and the Balts actually feel when their Western European nations are holding back a fair bit? And then from a North American context, politically, it becomes very difficult to keep support and explain support of why we should bear so much of that responsibility, when in many cases the Europeans just don't seem interested to wanting to make the effort themselves. What were some of the reasons, besides monetary and perhaps a bureaucratic mindset, that are keeping a lot of the Europeans from being able to at least show an equal effort than what we see with the American forces in Central and Eastern Europe?
Well, both sides are to blame on that, both Europe and North America. The Europeans are to blame because, as you said, they're not matching the level of U.S. involvement in responding to these threats. Once the Russians moved into Ukraine, the first NATO member that responded was the United States. We sent a detachment of the 173rd Brigade from Italy. We sent 600 troops from that unit to the three Baltic states and to Poland. So we deployed 150 paratroopers in each of those states. Then later, NATO caught up, and it expanded Baltic air policing. So whereas before there were four NATO jets flying out of Lithuania, we expanded that to 16 NATO jets flying out of the Baltic republics in air policing. That's going to be reduced by the end of this year back down to 8. So it will still be twice the level that it was before Crimea, but it will be half the level that it is now. There have been some significant European deployments that has not gotten their due amount of attention in the Western press. The Brits deployed their armor units into the Baltic and Poland. The first time they've done so for many years, and it's the farthest east British tanks had ever been in their history. And you also saw the French deployed some of their armor units into Poland for a major exercise there. The Dutch have sent units there. The Norwegians, the Danes have sent units. But I'm kind of perplexed by that because, on the one hand, they're sending these units to see a reassuring message to their NATO allies. But on the other hand, they're not very public about it. It's almost as if they're embarrassed to tell their own people, their own voters, that they're sending their military to help their NATO allies. I don't understand how that's helping the cause of both deterrence and reassurance, and also of educating the public of this is an obligation we have, this is a need we have, and this is how we're dealing with our NATO obligations to our allies. But I think overall the Europeans are not doing that much, primarily because of money. All of these exercises cost a lot. All of the defense budgets have been trimmed, cut into a lot of their readiness and operational abilities. And it's not cheap to send a tank to Estonia. There's some difficulties for that. The U.S., we've dealt with it. The Obama administration responded with the European Reassurance Initiative. But in a way, that's been part of the problem, because by President Obama responding unilaterally with the ERI, the European Response Reassurance Initiative, and us investing $1 billion to help with deterrence and reassurance measures and these types of exercises in the East, we really let the Europeans off the hook. I think it would have been much smarter for the ERI to have been declared as a multinational initiative, to sort of say this is what the U.S. is putting into the pot to deal with this new security threat from the East, and then to also link that to this is what the other NATO allies are putting into the pot. Then the U.S. is having a lot more exercises in the region, and we're spending a lot more activity there. Although I pointed out a few large exercises that deserve some merit and praise, the Europeans aren't doing as many exercises in the Central and Eastern Europe. And they're mostly just sort of rotational exercises that are one shot in and one shot out. So their deterrence value is of questionable quality. And the fact that all of these things are being done rotationally rather than in a permanent or until Russia's behavior improves type of level, it doesn't show that much commitment or long-term sustainability in terms of deterring the Russian threat. So I'm really curious at how Moscow is looking at these things. Publicly, of course, they're saying, you know, anything that the NATO or the U.S. does in Central Europe is a threat to Russian security. There was a one incident where the U.S. had some soldiers in Estonia, and four American vehicles took part in a parade near the Estonian center of near the Estonian town of Narva, which is near the border. The Russian headlines were, you know, U.S. tanks 50 meters away from the Russian border. And it was basically just four Stryker vehicles that were participating in this parade. So the Russians, for their own political agenda, are inflating any of the steps that the United States and NATO do. But at the same time, that shouldn't stop the West from taking proportional and measured steps to reassure their allies and to restore deterrence in Central Europe.
When I'm going to move to the nautical side for a minute, because I'm really curious. When this, A, what are the Russians doing with their submarines in the Baltic? And B, is there a NATO force that is currently anti-submarine capable to help patrol the Baltic, or is that one of those things where we're leaving it up to the Swedes and the other affected countries to do their own thing?
The Russian submarines have been active pretty far wide, not just in the Baltic, but in the North Sea, even in the Irish Sea. Mysterious submarines have been reported off of Great Britain's Trident base, so much so that, again, dealing with a readiness problem, the Brits didn't have enough anti-submarine capabilities, so they had to ask for NATO help. So the United States and France sent over some anti-submarine assets to help them look for this mysterious submarine off of the British Trident submarine base. So they're being pretty active on a large front. The NATO response, NATO has been deploying more naval units up into the Northeast region, in the Baltic Sea region. But the NATO standing maritime groups are not permanently deployed there. Ironically, what is usually deployed in the Baltic Sea are what's called the NATO Maritime Minesweeping Group. And these are rotational ships that are each year, month in and month out, are basically going through the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, trying to remove leftover mines from World War II and World War I, which are still a big threat to commercial traffic. So the main presence, and in fact the first naval ships that were sent by a NATO mission to the Baltics, were these NATO minesweepers. Of course, they're of limited value against the submarines, but it was a physical way to kind of carry the NATO flag over into those ports.
You brought up an interesting point about some of the exercises, because NATO can signal about what it's the flavor of the day, so to speak, with the exercises they give. You know, we saw over a decade ago there was a lot of exercises about crisis response operations and things of that manner. And see, if my memory serves me right, we have Swift Response 15. That's an airborne exercise with almost 5,000 airborne troops from a little over 10 countries. We also have Trident Juncture, which is having all those great words about the largest amphibious operation and the involvement of lots of NATO countries that have an amphibious capability. We're going to be doing some experimentation about sea basing as well. But you brought a point that unless they're recurring, that these one-offs really don't start to set a message. I think the message about a big airborne and a big amphibious operation is pretty nice. And it made me think back when you and I were little kids, the Reforger exercises during the height of the Cold War were regular, and they really sent a great message about reinforcing in the logistics trail to be able to support Western Europe. Do you see any initial discussions where people are echoing what you said, where, hey, these are pretty good exercises, maybe we should make them on a regular basis? Or is that desire that you see a lot in Western Europe, like you mentioned with the Dutch, which they really don't want to add, for whatever reasons, they don't want to advertise strength and resolve because they're almost embarrassed that they're doing it?
There are some talks about those lines. Certainly, the Eastern members of NATO would very much welcome those types of exercises. And you see in some of the military services, those type of talks being held. But at the political level, they're pretty much blocked. There's the political leadership, both in Washington and in most NATO capitals, just have very zero tolerance for that type of capability. As President Obama himself has said, we're not in a Cold War. He very much has a very Merkel type of orientation and vision of the relationship with Russia, in that he much prefers things to de-escalate rather than to rely on deterrence again to change Russian behavior. And these exercises, they're being done incrementally. They're being done in a limited way. So even though we've ratcheted up and we've increased, and Russia is, and the United States and NATO is sort of praising ourselves for the fact that we are increasing things, it's sort of kind of like my discussion of the Swedish defense budget. Yeah, they've increased it a little bit, but have they increased it enough for what they have to deal with? Are they increased it enough to achieve the political objective that they want? And I don't think we've done it at that level. One of the really troubling things to me, by what we call the exercise gap between NATO and Russia, is not just the size, the fact that the NATO exercises are far smaller than the Russian exercises, but the fact that the Russian have changed in the last 2 years to what are called the SNAP exercises. So the Russians are mobilizing tens of thousands of their troops on 24-hour notice. And these types of things are not what you would are hard to explain if they're going to be defensive. And they're very different from the way NATO has its exercises. So NATO exercises are planned months, if not years ahead. Trident Juncture has been on the plans for over a year already. And they're very transparent. We invite the media, we invite the Russians, the Chinese, and others to go see our stuff. And they're done in a very limited way away from the borders. But the Russians are having these surprise military exercises, which, by the way, they integrate into their offensive actions so that when they moved into Crimea, when they moved into Donbass, they had large mobilizations on the Russian border with Ukraine. So even though they're using these hybrid forces in other countries to subvert them from within, there's also a strong conventional component to it. So they move their heavy stuff near the border and to say, don't mess with our guys out of uniform because we've got plenty of guys in uniform next to your borders to back them up.
Well, one of the things you meant, I want to get to this, one of the things you mentioned that NATO is looking at is are issues that arise from the southern Mediterranean. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Right. In addition to the kind of conflict that we're seeing in post-Libya from the NATO operation there and the lack of closure on that NATO operation there, we've seen four regimes fall through the so-called Arab Revolution, the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring is on its fourth or fifth year by now. At the very least, it looks like we're going to be seeing an Arab decade of revolutions all along the southern and eastern Med, where a lot of instability, a lot of violence. We've already had the use of chemical weapons as a result of these revolutions. We're still seeing them being used by the Assad regime. And in the last couple of weeks, we've been seeing ISIS is using chemical weapons. We've seen ballistic missiles being launched at NATO territory coming out of Syria. So these are some very significant threats that are coming in from the south. And they're long-term threats that it doesn't look like there's going to be an easy fix to them now. And it doesn't look like the West is really committed to finding a permanent solution to these things. We're sort of pursuing policies now that are picking off key leaders. We're still losing some territory in some of these states. We're having a massive refugee problem with hundreds of thousands of refugees crossing European borders and becoming a major source of instability in Europe. Germany itself, their interior minister estimates that Germany is expecting 800,000 refugees this year. That's an unbelievable number to me, and that's just Germany. And then we're not even talking to the foreign fighters issue, where we had these increased terrorist attacks, not just Charlie Hebdo as sort of a franchise attack claiming support for ISIL, or the recent attack from the train going from Belgium to France that was stopped by U.S. servicemen who happened to be on that train. So you have these lone wolves and foreign fighters returning from their indoctrination, from their training that they're getting from these conflicts in the Middle East, and they're going back to Europe, and they're creating violence and a great deal of an effect there. To me, the biggest example of that is Charlie Hebdo, because as a result of those two men and the violence that they use in terrorism, the French government deployed 10,000 French military to help in their domestic protection. But that's quite of a ratio for a pinning force. Two terrorists are pinning down 10,000 French troops that cannot be deployed elsewhere. They can't be deployed to Central Africa to deal with Mali or the threat there. They can't be deployed to the east to help in deterrence against Russia. But they're stuck in France now merely to deal with domestic terrorist threat, and that was achieved just by two terrorists. We saw earlier the bombing attack on the trains against Madrid that pretty much changed an election in a NATO country. So these terrorist attacks, maybe small and militarily, aren't seen as quite as big as the Russian threat, but they're having a political effect and they're having consequences for NATO to deal with.
Well, George, we're coming up on just a minute and a half left on what's been a great hour. I want to give you a chance to let the listeners know what can they expect to see over at NATO Source coming up, and what's the one item that you think is kind of undertold about what's going on in the NATO alliance that people should, over the course of the next 6 to 9 months, perhaps keep an eye out for?
Well, the big issue is we're getting ready for the Warsaw Summit, which I think is going to be a lot more controversial and lively than the Wales Summit we had last September. NATO's response to the violence done by Russia against Ukraine at the Wales Summit was kind of to say, to huddle together in Great Britain and to say Article 5 is strong, Article 5 is ironclad, and we're all standing together. But that left a big question because they said very little about the gray zone. What about all the European countries who are not in NATO? What's going to be the fate of Ukraine if the Russians continue their military attacks like we saw with the artillery shelling in Mariupol in the last couple of weeks? What's going to be the fate of Georgia? What's going to be the fate of Sweden and Finland and all these states that don't have Article 5 protection And as we get closer to the Warsaw Summit, the key issue here is because the Poles are hosting it and because of the priorities of the new Polish government, the new president, he's being a lot more explicit and direct that Poland is demanding NATO bases in itself, in the Baltic states and in Romania and Bulgaria. And so we're seeing a lot more disagreement being done publicly. And it'll be challenging to see whether NATO is able to resolve these differences, or they're able to come to a compromise on how will they address this continuing need for reassurance by the Eastern allies and their need for what they continue to see as an escalation of Russian provocations, of Russian hostility, and NATO just kind of trying to downplay everything. And then the other big issue I think we need to stay on top of is really readiness, because it's a crisis that if it's not dealt with soon and it's not dealt with effectively, the rest of the things that NATO agrees to, it's fine to say yes on paper, but we actually need to start putting some money and some bodies into some of these missions to, like I said, restore deterrence in Europe.
Well, there we go. Thanks again, George, for a great hour. And a reminder to those listeners that joined us late, our guest for this hour to discuss NATO and the general security situation in Europe has been Dr. George Benitez. Hope everybody has a great end of summer. And until next time, we'll see you on the next edition of Midrats. Cheers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, George.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.